Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is Mike Cantu. Mike is one of the most successful investors that I know in Southern California, and he has also started teaching some of what he knows. Mike, welcome to our show.
Hi, Bruce.
Let's just cover a little bit prior to your real estate career starting. What did you do before real estate? And you started real estate pretty young, so you were involved in a sport of some kind.
Yes, from the time I was 16 till the time I was 21, I was a professional skateboarder on the Pepsi skateboard team. And I had started studying real estate somewhere around late 18 years old, early 19. And I continued to be a professional skateboarder while I worked on my education. When I finished my skateboarding at 21, I dove in full-time real estate and have been full-time since then. That was back in 1982.
And why real estate? Because at the time, I don't know, that was pretty, those interest rates in 1980 to 82, those were very unattractive. So
Bruce, I had no idea about interest rates or anything else. I saw a late-night infomercial with a young kid sitting on his surfboard that said he was worth $1 million, and he said the year before he was broke, a loser, and had no direction, and I thought that kind of fit that shoe right there, and I believed every single word of that half-hour infomercial, and that night a dream was born.
Interesting. Now, I don't think I've ever heard that story. Now, what was the info? Who was it?
It was actually a Robert Allen infomercial for their upcoming seminar, and they did a series of interviews. And the one that really hit me, though, was the kid sitting on the surfboard, because I recognized the beach in the background. It was Mission Beach in San Diego.
So someone you probably know was on that infomercial.
There's a good chance. And, yeah, I believed every word of it. I was too naive and optimistic, even doubted. I thought if it was on TV, it's got to be true. And, of course, I ended up going to the freebie class there, and then my roommate and myself decided we had to go to the weekend one. It was $500. Neither of us had $500, so we stuck around after the class, and we explained to them how we were going to do a two-for-one discount, but we were only going to use one manual. We were going to take turns using the chair, and we would not take up any extra space. They wouldn't even know we were there. They agreed to that. Then we went to work and got a $50 good student discount. We both were in school. Neither one of us were very good students. I remember Chuck pushed the envelope. He got us a AAA discount, another $50 off. Neither one of us had a AAA card, but we intended to get one. And he got finally one more $50 discount, to where they closed up everything and said, look, it's $350. Take it or leave it. No more discounts. And that was the beginning of my real estate career. And at that point in time, we still didn't have the $350 between the two of us.
That's a great story. Now, okay, where did the negotiating ability come from?
That was more probably desperation.
Okay.
I knew that was the cutting-edge info that was absolutely going to change my life. I wasn't happy where I'd been at that point in life, and I just thought, no, we're taking this class no matter what. Even if we have to sneak in, moonwalk in backwards, I was prepared to do whatever it took to get in that class.
That was one heck of an infomercial.
That was my first exposure to it. I thought, this is it. All I got to do is take this class, and I'm home free.
Now, the gist of the class when you took it, was it sort of geared up to own and hold the properties or to make money by buying and selling it?
It was more geared up to owning and holding them. It had a few techniques in there for buying and selling, but it was more about putting together a rental portfolio, and it was, I think there was 101 ways to purchase real estate, no money down. I think that was the theme of it. And I do remember after sitting in the two-day class driving home with Chuck, and I said, Chuck, what the heck was that mortgage thing they talked about all weekend? And he looked at me and said, I don't know. I was hoping you knew.
How many classes do you think you've taken? Do you have any idea?
I know it's well over 100, Bruce. I just counting the notebooks in my library, and I only keep the good notebooks from the classes that had substance to them that I figured I'd refer back to the manual. And I know there's somewhere between 100 and 150 seminar manuals in my library.
I honestly know it dawns on me every time I see you in something that I'm teaching that you have to know nearly as much as almost any subject I can come up with. So why do you still keep going to all the education when you're really capable of doing it as well, if not better, than most people that teach it?
Well, there are several reasons, Bruce, and one of them you have to do with. You had mentioned the word tiebreaker. And ever since I heard that term, I thought, that will rationalize and justify me going to seminars for the rest of my life. If I can get one tiebreaker in there, when it boils down to me and one other person that tipped the scales in my favor, it was mission accomplished. I do have an insatiable appetite for knowledge that pertains to my livelihood that I just as soon stack the deck in my favor, and also to stay current on the market.
When did you actually start thinking, I'm going to keep these properties and end up gradually paying them off? When did you really start doing that?
That was originally my plan, Bruce, going out of the gate. I just wanted my 10 houses initially, and I figured once I did 10 transactions, we figured out how to get them paid for, and I was going to be home free. So that was my original plan going into real estate. I had no idea that it was going to take hundreds and hundreds of transactions and modified game plan and revised game plan, repaired game plan. I just kept changing things and kind of raised the bar as I kept progressing. I'd reach my goal and realize that I'm a long ways from done in this business, so I just kept doing more deals.
So approximately how long did it take to get to the free 10 houses?
Now, early on, Bruce, I did not get to those free 10 houses. Instead, with my partner and mentor, Mick, we ended up, I'm going to say, close to 40 houses. They were all leveraged, and of that pile of 40, I'm going to say 37 of them were probably the wrong house in the wrong neighborhood.
Okay.
And Mick, his background was as a builder and as a keeper person, not a flipper person, so I really had to do a sales pitch on him on every single house that I talked him into selling. He had a big rental income, and I had zero, and I had to eat.
Okay.
So every now and then we did have to sell one, but we did have cash flow on them. But it was very, very management intensive from the wrong properties.
Who has the best model for keeper properties that you've seen?
Now, hands down, out of all the instructors out there, hands down, if I could only emulate one, have the portfolio of one and lifestyle and everything else, it would, without a doubt, be John Schaub. He has had probably the biggest influence on the type of property that I've kept over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And his philosophy was, it's okay to start with the B and C plus neighborhoods, but the game plan would be to grow them up in value, amortize the debt down, and then pair them up and trade for an A neighborhood house. I think his philosophy was, every year, look at your portfolio, take the worst house out to pasture and shoot it, replace it with a better house. And constantly upgrade with the plan of eventually you will have no junk.
What's the difference between a B and a C neighborhood?
I grade them just from the overall appearance and the occupants in the neighborhood. A C plus, or the difference between a B and a C neighborhood, there's, in my world, it has a lot to do with the distance. I try and keep stuff within 15 minutes of my office. I really would prefer not to get on the freeway to do rental properties. And the farther out they are, I could have what would be an A property in my local marketplace here, but if you put a 30-mile distance on it and get it out towards San Bernardino, even in the best neighborhood, the best-case scenario, that's going to be a B property in my world because of the location of it. Or somebody that lived out there, they'd say, oh, no, that's an A property. It's in my backyard. So the geographical distance has a lot to do with the rating also.
How important has your ability to buy below market, how important has that been to your ability to end up with these free and clear properties ultimately?
The absolute critical component in there. If I paid retail for everything, I would have to go into the holding plan of waiting 30 years till they paid off, probably have a large negative cash flow going out of the gate. So I really didn't have the opportunity to keep anything unless I absolutely stole it, made a great deal on it, and that was the stuff that I kept. Yeah, the rest of the stuff didn't make any sense.
Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. I hear people say every year it's the best year to buy real estate. Would you say 2009 might be the best buy and hold opportunity you've ever seen?
Absolutely. I'm already seeing the prices. The biggest difference is the rents that are in the marketplace right now. When I first started real estate, I was told that the magic number was 0.75% per month was your target, meaning on a $100,000 house, you should shoot for $750 in rent. I was told that the old rule of thumb was 1% And those days will be gone forever. And I just recently, using an example of a property that I bought that was out in Highland, I did end up wholesaling it, but I took a good hard look at, from the rental standpoint, I paid $40,000 for that house, and market rents for that is somewhere between $1,000 and $1,100, which is pretty close to a 2% net after your expenses.
Yeah, that should be safe, even if rents come down some. That's a very safe formula.
Right, and that one can be done. You can have double-digit interest rates on your loan and still make a lot of sense out of that deal.
Just curious, what was the source of that deal?
That was actually a property that I went to an auction, was the bidder. They rejected it. The listing agent stayed in contact with me. I think at the time it was listed at 109, and I just kept, she kept coming back every time they did a price reduction. I'd just say 40, 40, 40, and the last time she called, she says, I know, it's 40. You wanted it at 40? I said, 40. She said, congratulations, you just bought a house.
And how long did that time, what was the time frame involved in getting a 60% discount or more off of?
That was late November to mid-January.
I guess that begs the next question. Have you ever seen anything like this as far as price declines?
Not even remotely close, and I think this came faster and harder than anybody could have possibly expected, to where I'm still amazed with it. And I was making the comment jokingly, I can't wait for the stuff to get free. Talking to a friend this morning, he said some of that Detroit stuff that I know was being bought in bulk for around $200 a house, he said he actually had a pile of it given to him. Lenders wanted off their books from a liability standpoint. He raised his hand. He had to sign some paperwork saying the lender's completely off the hook, but they gave it to him.
They gave it to him. Well, that is a new one. I don't think California will get there, but I'll bet there's some things that we'll see that has a one in front of it.
Well, I actually have a bet with a good friend of mine because we bought in the 90s lots of properties in the mid to upper teens, and the deal is first person to buy a house in the teens buys the other one dinner.
It's coming. It's definitely going to come this year.
Right.
Okay. Do you still talk to owners?
Very sparingly. Not nearly as much as I used to. I still do a probate mailer, so I get those occasional calls. I still get the stragglers from past marketing efforts. And in late November through December, I did a test drive on a new mailer for going after properties with terms. I got a decent response, but I enjoyed talking to the sellers, but I'm going to say two-thirds of them are still in denial over what's happened in the marketplace. So I'm putting that program on the shelf for the time being.
It kind of makes sense they'd be uninformed, honestly, about how what their property is worth, because if it was worth 30% more 90 days ago, you can understand that if this isn't their business, how in the world would they know that's just what happened?
Right.
So, yeah, that makes sense. Do you find when you have when we have a market where you can talk to the owners and it's, they're a good target, are they, the rentals that you've had, how many would you say in percentage ended up carrying the paper to make that rental make sense?
I did a lot more of that, Bruce, in the 80s and in the 90s. The stuff that I picked up from 2000 to 2003, most of those I borrowed the money. It was either private money. I didn't go to the bank at all. I was never really much of a borrower. But I did not do, I take that back, two of them that I can think of. Two of them after the year 2000, they were both, I think one was 2001 and the last one was 2003. But in the 90s, a lot of the sellers carried, and in the 80s, I didn't have much of a choice. That was pretty much my business model that I counted on if I was going to keep something.
Okay. If you had a chance to have one do-over in 2006 and 7 at the top of the market, what would it be?
Probably would have taken a two-year vacation. I worked and worked and worked to maintain status quo, and I don't think I've ever worked that hard. And looking back, I think, what for?
Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. Now, you kept a lot of properties after that run-up, and your intention was always to do that. So that really didn't matter to you that the prices had really exceeded your wildest imagination. You owned them for a different reason. So,
right. I looked at the equity as a byproduct of what I set out to accomplish. Just watched all the equity fall out of the sky and land on the rent houses. That was never what I intended. The whole game plan after watching that infomercial back in 1982, the written game plan was to have enough rental income to live life on my terms. That's all I was ever after out of this business.
That's that right there is a tremendous sentence. You have known people that have gotten themselves to that place.
Yes.
And then decided to refi and get to another place. How did that work out for them?
Some of them very well, and other people, it was their downfall. The disciplined, my mentor, Mick, I've watched him take that to unbelievable heights. His attitude always was, you make your money in real estate, and once you grow it up, you take it out of real estate, that there's much more profitable games to play. Now, that doesn't mean get rid of the real estate. He would pull the money out at 6% and put it to work at 20% plus and take the spread out of there, which makes a lot of business sense, but there's a lot of moving parts in there, and there's a lot of management and bookkeeping to keep track of all of that stuff. I've always come from the school of simplicity, just dumb it down to where sixth grade level when you can still do it.
So every time you touch a property, you give it sort of a job description.
Absolutely.
So the job description for a permanent keeper is to send you a check every month just forever.
Yes. And the initial, while it still has a loan on it, the job description is to grow up in value, amortize down in debt, and to take care of me in my later part of middle age and old age. And then once the debt is completely removed from it, then it gets a very, very specific job description. Like my daughter and myself, she's 20 years old, goes to school full time. We have a house that covers gas for both cars. We have a utility house that covers her utilities at her residence, that covers my utilities at my residence. We have a food house that 100% of the income is for our food budget. We have an insurance house that covers our medical insurance, our car insurance. Any of life's recurring expenses, we've taken a house and given it that job description to take care of that every 30 days.
It doesn't sound like any of these will be refied then.
Oh, absolutely not. The game plan is to never touch that stuff.
Now, an economist hearing you say that would say that's a very unsophisticated plan.
Yes.
Except for they never have anything.
No, I was at a seminar last year, and a good friend of mine was talking to the instructor, and they were talking about, Rick had mentioned his friend with these free and clear houses, and the guy kind of went off on a tangent, and he didn't realize I was in the room, and he started telling the class about this guy that had all this equity, that it was just unbelievable how he wouldn't unlock it and take it to the next level. And I kept raising my hand asking questions about this guy, and finally he put two and two together. Well, I didn't want to embarrass him, because a very good friend of mine and an instructor told me a story a couple of years ago that just really hurt, and it was a man that had spent 25 years putting together a Florida portfolio. They were all three-bedroom, one-bath, about 1,000-square-foot block houses, and after 25 years, he had free and cleared 25 of them. That was his mission in life, and they were worth about $100,000 apiece. And they were free and clear. He was home free. Then he went to one of these unlock your equity seminars, take it to the next level, and he was told that he should be into a $10 million building, and the game plan they came up with was to sell all 25 houses, do a 1031 exchange, put 25% down on a $10 million building. That's exactly what they did against everybody's advice that he knew. He had visions of the big picture, and if you fast forward 3 years after he did that play, the commercial building was worth about $6.5 million. It was half vacant, and the man's in bankruptcy because
Wow. He
took it one more step, one more bridge, and that one collapsed.
And it was into a world that he wasn't an expert at.
Out of his area of expertise, and the people that did the seminar got a slice of the action, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, no, that was a lifetime of work, and it was tempting at the top of the market. Don't kid yourself, Bruce. I looked at the bottom line there and had thoughts about cashing out, and I thought, no, this is a plan that I made 26 years ago and hung on to that plan through good times and bad, and I'm not about to stay up late one night and change it all midway through life. I thought, no, if I'm going to come up with a different plan, I'm going to start over. Just take what's on the table now, push it off the table, and start with a new pile, and that's kind of my game plan for this market right now.
Well, tell me then, what is the plan for the upcoming market, and you're going to leave the equity, that's what you just said, that's permanent. It's staying over there paying all the stuff. And now the new plan is what?
To collect two piles of houses. I broke them into two categories. The first category I call the bling pile. Those are the pretty houses in the A neighborhood that on a good day they'll break even, that most likely won't cash flow going out of the gate, even if you buy them really cheap. And the second pile of houses is the stuff I call the push forward pile. That is the stuff that my intent is to grow up in value, amortize ties down the debt over the next 5 to 10 years, and use those as a tool that once there's enough equity in them to start selling them off and use the proceeds to pay off the good pile. Very similar to what I did last time around. That was one of the techniques, and I like that plan the best. So that's definitely part of my game plan.
Did you ultimately pay off more houses because of price increases than amortization?
Oh, absolutely. See, I've never been one to wait 30 years to do anything. I thought, let's just get this stuff, get the show on the road and get it out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one house actually amortized that I took a loan subject to back in 1982, and I'm going to say it was around 2003 where I'd witnessed all the amortization down to just the last few payments, which I ended up writing a check. I didn't quite get that one through, but I've only had a few seller carry shorter-term amortized loans fully put themselves out. Most of the stuff, once it got down close enough to where I'd do some deals and just pay it off.
Mm-hmm. How mentally tough is it to come off the ground after you literally have been financially independent, and all of a sudden this disaster hits this guy? You've been through some tough times in the early 90s, so, and there's a lot of people facing things that they never thought they'd face. So
right.
How do you make a comeback after you thought you had it all whipped and now you're right back where you started from?
You review the fundamentals, figure out what got you there in the first place, and do the same things over again. I watched a lot of people deviate from the fundamentals the last few years of the market and get themselves in positions that they really wish they weren't in right now.
How's the fact that you've had regular income coming from these homes, how has that changed how calm you've been, let's say, over the last couple of years in relationship to other people that have, you know, just got hit blindsided by this?
I planned for this, Bruce. I went through the 90s, and my whole mantra through the 90s was just give me one more chance. I won't screw it up this time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was absolutely planned. So, and I tried to push that off on a lot of other people, but they had not been through the downturn of the early 90s and just were totally in denial over the market cycles. And, yeah, I just wish more of my friends had paid attention.
Yeah, real estate became very non-threatening and seemed that there really wasn't much risk to it. And I'm very glad I went through the 90s. And that's, you know, I've talked about this before. I think when you don't go through the pain of solving something, I don't think you learn the lesson completely.
No, you don't. Absolutely not. And it's what you become after going through that kind of dictates how you do business after that.
Yeah, I mean, it really was worth getting to safe ground. If I hadn't gone through 1990, to 92, I wouldn't have had the same mindset of being conservative and making sure that the companies that I own got to the safe ground too and didn't have to take risk. So I'm very grateful for that lousy time.
Right, and the fact that I survived that, I did come up with a whole bunch of lessons that dictate how I'll do business forever. And rule number one is you never, ever bet more than 10% of the farm on any venture, no matter what. Nothing more than 10% could ever be at risk. And I'm at a point now to where I don't even want to put anywhere near 10% at risk.
Right.
But there was a point where I just pushed the whole pile forward and let it roll and let it ride and cross collateralize and put blanket mortgages on stuff and nope anymore. Everything I do has to stand on its own. Each individual deal has to carry its own weight. There's nothing around it to prop it up except me.
That's a good way not to go backwards.
Exactly. Or if that deal falls down, well, you just look at the mess you made and figure out how to clean that mess up and that one only. It doesn't do the domino effect on everything else. In the 90s, I realized when the market changed in 91, I had been in business for a full decade, and everything I owned was in jeopardy. I had blanket mortgages and had cross-collateralized it, and if I didn't clean that mess up, I was going to have nothing but some experience to show for the first decade of work.
Mike, we're out of time for this segment. I'm just going to mention Mike is teaching a rental seminar for us on February 21st. You can sign up for that event at the website. And in our next segment, we'll be talking predominantly about rentals. So, Mike, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Bruce.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.